was a historical organizing effort and a day of victory for Indigenous people.
Absolutely amazing, Nick. We talked to you right after you talked to the pardon office. You were in South Dakota then, after you went to Washington, D.C. Finally, on the issue of Leonard Peltier going home, how is his health?
He needs to see a doctor right away. We were a little bit concerned that he's not going home until the 18th, that the order doesn't go into effect till the 18th. He needs to see a doctor immediately, and they don't have the medical facilities at Coleman Prison, federal prison, to meet his medical needs right now. So we will be asking this current, the incoming administration for relief for medical purposes to try to get him home a little bit sooner. And they do have the ability to do that at the Bureau of Prisons level. And so we're going to be asking for that so we can get this, him to see a doctor. But realistically, we also understand that there's a good chance that he's probably not coming home till the 18th, even though we're trying to get him home sooner. But we really want to get him home sooner because his health is continuing to deteriorate, and he's excited to come home, but we got to make his health and his safety number one priority.
Nick Tilson, you've also worked on climate issues for years. On Monday, Trump signed an executive order to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement again.
The next item here is the withdrawal from the Paris Climate Treaty. We're going to save over $1 trillion by withdrawing from that treaty.
So you hear him signing this in the Capital One arena with 20,000 people cheering. The significance of this, Nick.
It's terrible. It's terrible for everybody around the world, because not only the Paris Climate Agreements, but the agreements to for the most powerful countries in the world to come together to fight climate change and set bars for it, to force corporations and force countries to be able to have regulations in place, and to pull these back is to put our environment at risk, and to put human rights at risk, and to put and these decisions are going to expedite climate change. And at a time when climate change is a global crisis issue affecting all of humanity, and with Indigenous people, it means a direct threat to us and our homelands, because we are maintaining, we're 5% of the world's population, but steward 80% of the world's biological diversity on behalf of all of humanity. And so that means when him pulling out of the Paris Accords, it means that he's going to make Indigenous communities and Indigenous homelands sacrifice zones. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be on the front lines having to fight these corporations, because now they're and going to end up into our territories completely deregulated.
Nick, there's so much to talk to you about, but I want to quickly, it's a fire hose of executive orders. President Trump also signed an executive order Monday calling for North America's tallest peak, Denali, in Alaska, to be renamed Mount McKinley after President McKinley. He said, showing respect to Ohio and to the president. Can you talk about the significance of what Obama renamed in 2015?
Well, renaming these, we have been in this effort to rename our territories after what we call them as Indigenous people. And this effort to try to erase Indigenous people and erase our identities, that's what this is. It is manifest destiny in its modern form. It is colonial rule that is trying to control the narrative, and it's trying to erase Indigenous people. And so we're going to continue to fight to hold on to our names. We're going to continue to fight to hold on to our identity. And we're going to use this energy that we have in Indian country right now, that we have gotten from this victory in fighting for Leonard Peltier, to protect our homelands and to protect the names, and to make sure that they won't erase us. And you can guarantee the Indigenous people that we're going to be on the front lines fighting this administration and making a way for our people and fighting for human rights everywhere.
Well, Nick, we want to thank you for being with us. Nick Tilson, founder and CEO of the NDN Collective. You can go to Democracy Now! To see all our coverage of Leonard Peltier, including interviews with him. Again, at the age of 80, Leonard Peltier is going home after almost half a century in prison. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, the Guster, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnock, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tim Maria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randall, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hey, it's Riona Duncan, and I'm here with Professor Kathy Newman to talk about banned books on Forbes Avenue, and this is on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hello, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
The reason I'm talking with Professor Newman about banned books is because you run a banned books class. So how did you end up offering that class?
I don't remember what the initial inspiration was. I think the original title was Censored Texts. But starting about 20, 25 years ago, I just got interested in the phenomenon, and I noticed that it was happening more and more. And then I got interested in the history of it. And every time you poke at a case of book banning, you find something different and you find something interesting. So I taught the class originally. I had like a set of texts that would change, and the students would write papers on what we were reading. And then 6 years ago, I changed to the format I have now, where students do original, in-depth, high-quality research on a single case of book banning. And I found that CMU students really rose to the occasion and did really good work. So I'm enjoying this new format.
What would you say you've learned from having this class?
It is so cool to see what students are interested in. I have students from all over the world, and so a lot of students want to work on books that were banned in their home country. So China, a student came up to me today and said she wanted to do a play that's been banned in Colombia. So I learn about books from all over the world. That's one super cool thing. And then I think students who choose books that have been banned more recently, I've helped students do things like find the video of the school board meeting where the book was banned. And so just getting to see human beings in action doing this thing that we kind of think of as nefarious or behind closed doors, like actually being able to see the school board meeting where it happened is really cool.
So you were talking about the trend that you noticed 25 years ago. Would you say that it still holds? Are we banning more books than we ever have?
I don't remember what I was inspired by 25 years ago exactly, but certainly since 2019, 2020, there has just been like a hockey stick graph. Like it is like right now, I would say is probably the most challenges in American history are happening to books right now. The group that really tracks that is PEN America. They come out with a report every 1 to 2 years. And so they're just showing that there's more and more parts of the country and more kinds of books and more different kinds of people who are challenging books. So I think I came up with the idea for this class, and now it's really more relevant than ever before.
So I know there's a lot of people trying to combat that with social media, online library cards, that kind of thing.
Yes. I think sometime in the last couple of years, maybe the Brooklyn Public Library made it possible for anybody in the country to get a library card there, and then they could get electronic books or audiobooks. So I think, I mean, here, this is one of the ironies. In some ways, information has never been more accessible, more available, cheaper. And so it kind of raises the question, why challenge a book if somebody can just get it some other way? What is the political capital that's being expended to say, I want this book out of this public library, or I want this book out of my kid's curriculum, or I want this book out of my kid's library? So I think the questions are in some ways more vexing now, because it just begs the question. And also, if you hand your 12-year-old a smartphone, why are you also trying to take a book out of that 12-year-old's classroom? It just doesn't make any sense.
No, although people on both sides of the political argument have decided to ban books for various reasons.
Definitely. There's not like one political group that has a monopoly on saying, I don't want my kid to read this book, or I don't want any kids to read this book. But there has been a more easy to track movement from American political conservatives since the Reagan era, and especially in the last 5 years. After Trump lost the 2020 election, there was an attempt by sort of the movement that was around Trump to attack school boards and to sort of take on cultural issues. And so critical race theory, books by diverse authors, books by queer authors, those books really started to come under attack kind of in the wake of that presidential loss.
So one of the reasons I'm talking to you today, beyond this being a great topic, is that we do have Banned Books Week coming up in late September. Do you feel like that celebration helps counteract this push towards book banning, or does it possibly kind of not do enough?
Yeah, there's a real irony that's present in both book banning and book defending. Banned Books Week was the brainchild of a librarian from Pittsburgh. Her name was Judith Krug, and she was she worked for the American Library Association, and she went to the American Booksellers Association and said, you know, we're seeing this uptake in challenges. Why don't we band together and promote the idea that we should have the freedom to read? And so at a big book convention in 1982, there was the first kind of celebration or recognition of banned books. And there's been one every year since 1982. I think the irony is that every year when Banned Books Week comes around, somebody writes an article that says there's no such thing as a banned book in America. And it's true that it's incredibly rare that any governmental agency will ever take action against a book. We don't live in a totalitarian country where you could be jailed for what you write, at least not today. And so there's some irony that the presence of Banned Books Week tends to sort of incite opposition to the use of the term banned books, and to the whole kind of, people say it's hysterical, it's sort of pearl-clutching, it's much ado about nothing. At the same time, there's another ironic reaction, is that oftentimes when a book is targeted and then that target is publicized, that increases sales of the book. So the graphic novel Mouse was challenged by a Tennessee school board in January of 2022. And almost as soon as it was publicly known, that book just started flying off the shelves and they had to print some extra runs. So I think there's just irony on both sides. When you overtly try to defend books, you get attacked for sort of exaggerating the state of book banning. When you attack books, you often inadvertently promote them. There's an action and an opposite reaction that happens in both moves, both challenging and defending.
Given you've been studying banned books and teaching about them for so long, what would you say causes people to challenge them, especially when this causes such a counterswing to the other direction?
I mean, I think the positive that I see in book challenging is that it's a reminder, and a really happy reminder for me, because I'm an English professor, that books are powerful, that books incite strong emotions, that they make people want to do something, even if that thing is to close the book and try to take it away from other people. So I think it's evidence that in this kind of information-saturated world, we still value books and we still find them to be life-changing in a certain way. I think the other thing that I notice is that the internet and social media, I think, has allowed people to organize and exchange information at a much higher rate. So, for example, The Grapes of Wrath was banned by Kern County, California in 1939. And there was like a little 2-inch newspaper squib about it. And that newspaper squib got reprinted on a wire service. And so then a few other county libraries and city libraries took up the challenge and said, yes, we agree. We think Grapes of Wrath is offensive and we're going to ban it. In some cases, there's one library that burned it. They had a ceremonial burning of it. So the newspaper was kind of the viral media of the day. Today, if somebody challenges a book, it's often part of a list that circulates through political groups. There's a conservative political group called Moms for Liberty that has chapters in different states. And then book defenders also are organized on state levels. So there's ACLU chapters in many, many American cities. So I think what I'm noticing is that in some ways, even though it's probably more futile to challenge a book than ever before, people can share information about what books to target and how to attack them. It's easier to share that information than it's ever been in the history of books.
Would you say that graphic novels, for example, you mentioned Mouse, are especially easy to target with this then?
Absolutely. I mean, graphic novels are targeted, you know, I don't remember what the percentage differential is, but it's at a much greater rate than books that just have words on the page. I do think there's a famous judge who said, I don't know what art is versus pornography, but I know it when I see it. So we somehow trust our eyes to tell us if something is offensive or bad or wrong. And that visual information, we believe that we can adjudicate it in a way that we somehow maybe don't feel like we can adjudicate the written word in the same way. So graphic novels are constantly under attack. Anne Frank is a frequently banned book, The Diary of Anne Frank, but the graphic novel of The Diary of Anne Frank, banned and challenged even more. Things having to do with the Holocaust, like Mouse, Diary of Anne Frank, those have really been hot button books in recent years. Other graphic novels that are under attack, genderqueer, coming of age memoir about a non-binary author. The most banned book in America, basically since the day it was published.
You mentioned that Holocaust and queer issues are a hot topic. Is there anything else that tends to be banned?
One of the people that we study in my class is one of the top banned book researchers in the U.S., and her name is Emily Knox. She teaches at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. So she's just a fantastic scholar, and she has a wonderful article about how when books get challenged, it tends to be diverse books that get challenged. And what she means by diverse books is books by authors who are considered to have some kind of marginal identity in that moment or in some past historical moment. So books by women, books by African-American authors, books by queer authors, books by Native American authors, Asian American, Indian American, Latino American, those books tend to be the most targeted. And Knox, I don't know if she would call herself a free speech absolutist, but she would really challenge anybody who wants to ban books because her argument is ultimately if when bans and challenges go forward, they tend to fall on the text written by more marginal authors more than any other kind of author. So you might think, oh, I don't want To Kill a Mockingbird taught because the author used the N-word. But then it turns out that most books that are banned for the use of the N-word are written by African-American authors. So you might think that you have the best intentions when you're trying to get a book out of circulation, but the end result is that the people who get silenced are the people that we really need to hear from the most.
Thank you so much. I'm Riona. I'm here with Professor Kathy Newman talking about banned books. So I wanted to situate banned books in the larger context of free speech. How do banned books and free speech go hand in hand, do you think?
I love that question because I always start the class with the First Amendment. And I think that when students hear the word free speech, and if they haven't had to do AP Gov or, you know, some really intensive civics course, you just think, I have free speech. I can say whatever I want. And the First Amendment is 45 words, and not that many of those words are about free speech. And all it says is Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of the speech. And that actually isn't very specific and doesn't actually give you the freedom to say whatever you want. It only says that Congress shall make no law. So I really like to think about how kind of weird those 45 words are and how limited they are in terms of what we know how to do with them. One thing that is really shocking to me right now is how many state legislatures are passing laws against books. And the 1619 Project has been banned by at least a dozen state legislatures across the country. So I haven't seen any of those cases go up to the Supreme Court, but I sort of can't believe that we are actually passing laws against books, even despite the First Amendment. And I don't know if a state legislature is, I guess, distinct from Congress, but I honestly just don't understand it, can't figure it out. But I think that the openness, the vagueness, maybe the simplicity of the First Amendment does give us a real opportunity to think about what it means to have free speech and what the American Library Association calls the freedom to read. The ALA has a Reader's Bill of Rights or Library Bill of Rights that I teach in the class, and I can't recite it chapter and verse, but the basic idea is that you have the freedom to receive information. And I think that is much more comprehensive than simply the idea that Congress shall pass no law. Because if I have the freedom to receive information, if you have the freedom to receive information, then we can't be prevented from accessing a book in the library that a librarian has deemed appropriate or reading a book in a class that a teacher has deemed appropriate. We are free to receive that information. And I think one thing that's really interesting about this political moment is that many people have perceived the conservative party, the Republican Party in America, to be the party of freedom, of liberty. I don't want big government. I don't want to be taxed. I don't want to be told that I can't own or carry a gun. But that movement of liberty and freedom, going into schools and saying, you can't have this book in my child's classroom or in my child's school, seems to be sort of going against this message of freedom that we've been hearing for a long time. So I do think this is an exciting moment to think about what freedom is, freedom to and freedom from. And I think in some ways, the freedom to receive information protects, if that was enshrined in our Constitution, it would protect us from the kinds of bans and challenges we're seeing so frequently right now.
Yeah, it's a really thorny issue, though, because even if Congress doesn't make any law or the government doesn't make any laws, there's still society which can kind of chill free speech. For example, cancel culture.
Yeah, I put cancel culture at the very end of the class and kind of save it for the last week, because I find that 18 to 22-year-olds are pretty comfortable with the idea that we shouldn't be banning and challenging books, but are maybe more interested in canceling as a project. So I try to have us spend the whole semester looking critically at book banning and then thinking about what's the difference and what's the similarity. And I think I study the history of consumer activism, the history of boycotts. So I sort of put canceling a little bit more on the side of consumer culture. I don't want to read J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter books, somebody might say. Then you have kind of extreme versions of that where people were destroying their Keurigs sometime in the last few years, because I think Keurig had a progressive advertising message but the idea, like, I'm not going to buy this product because of what the product represents or because of what the author did and I don't agree with it. So I'm okay with consumer activism. I think it's fine. I do find that the accusation that somebody has been canceled tends to be overblown, in the sense that a lot of so-called canceled people still have their platforms. I do think it's really interesting when it crosses over into labor. So I think the case I'm thinking of is the case of Amy Cooper, who met an African-American man named Chris Cooper in Central Park. She had her dog with her in an area where you're not supposed to have dogs because it's a bird area. He said, "Could you please take your dog out of here so I can watch birds?" And she videoed him saying that, and she actually did call the police and say, "There's an African-American man threatening me in the Ramble." I think that was the name of the area of the park. She was fired from her job. Should people lose their jobs because they were caught being racist and idiotic on social media? I don't know. That's a hard question for me. You do not have free speech at work. 100%. And I think, again, people come into my class thinking, oh, I have free speech. I can say whatever I want, wherever I want. Your employer can fire you for what you say. So I do get really interested in kind of the layers and contradictions that come out when you start thinking about the similarities and the differences between banned books and cancel culture.
Taking it back a little closer to banned books, people can also be fired for perhaps giving a child access to a book. So I feel like that also verges onto labor.
It does. Teachers and librarians are just under so much duress right now for being in the public eye around these issues. They are getting threatened with arrest, more kind of garden variety bullying, death threats, digital harassment, that sort of thing. So yeah, I'm definitely against that. I mean, I think these are professionals who have training in how to tell if a book is actually age appropriate. And I am someone who is very likely to trust professionals in this situation. I mean, granted, I am a professional teacher myself, but I am not paid by the state of Pennsylvania. I am paid by the undergraduates of Carnegie Mellon. So I do think that people are really having to become heroes when they just went to school to be a teacher or a librarian. And it's really tough right now for those folks.
I feel like, for example, the American Library Association, by hosting Banned Books Week, is somewhat seen to have taken a political side.
I think the ALA organizations like PEN America, if you look at their public rhetoric, I mean, they are very careful to say that they're against book bans, no matter who is launching it. I know in California, progressive parents have banded together to challenge books like To Kill a Mockingbird or Huckleberry Finn, again, for, inadequately respectful portrayals of African Americans and use of the N-word. So you could say that was a liberal or left book ban. I think that when I look at the numbers, they just don't compare in a balanced way. So at least right now, I would say liberals are not going about the work of book banning and challenging to the extent that conservatives are.
Well, conservatives seem, per my observations, to be a bit more uptight about sexuality in texts.
I think something like 80 to 90% of most book challenges come around the question of obscenity, age appropriateness, portrayals of sex and sexuality. So I think as we've had a real, what I see is real positive movement in having more public gay authors telling queer stories, there has been, I think, a conservative backlash against that. I think there is a fear, and I don't think this fear even has like a politics per se, that your kids might learn something at school that will lead them to do something you don't want them to do. And I know that, you know, that's something I've struggled with as a parent. You know, especially public schools, like ideally they're going to be exposed to thoughts, ideas, authors, points of view that aren't available in a single family. To my mind, that's the whole point of the project of public education. And, you know, something when we were talking before about free speech and rights, I think one of the things that the Constitution doesn't tell us how to do is what happens when my right to free speech interferes with, say, some other right that I might possess. So I do think that we don't have a formula. We don't have a mathematical formula for figuring out whose rights trump other people's rights. Maybe you could answer a question for me, which is when you started the banned books class last fall, like, what was your thought on kind of the issue and how did that change over the course of the semester? How are you thinking about it now?
I'm from Chicago. So originally I thought, well, you know, that doesn't happen here, which isn't actually true even. And people who are banning books are just doing it because they feel that they can't control their children. But I feel like I did gain more sympathy for the perspective. Even if I don't necessarily agree with banning books, I do see why, well, age appropriateness, I would leave it to the professionals, but I do see the arguments for that being a major problem.
Yeah, I'm happy you said that because I do challenge my students every fall to try and imagine some scenario in their life. I mean, you know, most of you aren't really even at the point where you're even thinking about having children. I think that something really changed for me when I had kids. You know, I just saw the education system differently than when I was in it myself. So to imagine some kind of scenario where you might really disagree with somebody who wants to teach your kid something. So I think I do encourage everybody to try to empathize and take the position of and imagine being so upset about something that you could get very political about it.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to end this. So this has been Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Riona Duncan, and I've got Professor Kathy Newman here with me. We were talking about banned books. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. It's lovely to speak with you.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.
I'm Ella Harp, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Right. it's Tori DeVito. In every family, small conversations can make a big impact. Like when my dad shared his experiences as an alcoholic.
Your honesty about that part of your life gave me a sense of integrity that I wanted to uphold in my own life.
I wanted you to know from someone who's been in recovery more than 30 years now that hard work is what creates success, not alcohol or other drugs. I said it a lot, and I'm glad you took it to heart.
Talk. They hear you. For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
You are listening to 88.3 FM, WRCT, Pittsburgh.
I go out walking after midnight, out in the moonlight, just like we used to do. I'm always walking after midnight.
Let me walk in, for I must
darling, I do. Please help me, I'm falling in love with you. Say hey, good looking, what you got cooking? Us a brand new recipe. I got a hot rod Ford and a $2 bill, and I know a spot right over the hill. There's soda pop and the dancing spree. So if you wanna have fun, come along with me. Say, hey, good looking, what you got cooking? How's about cooking something up with me?
Saginaw fisherman, too many times he came home with too little pay.
I love the girl
in Saginaw, Michigan. The daughter of a wealthy man, but he called me for that son of a Saginaw fisherman. And not good enough to claim his daughter's hand. Now I'm up here in Alaska, looking around for gold. Like a crazy fool, I'm a-digging in this frozen grounds of coal. But with each new day, I pray I'll strike it rich, and then I'll go back home. By my love to Saginaw, Michigan. I wrote my love in Saginaw, Michigan. I said, honey, I'm coming home, please wait for me. And you can tell your dad I'm coming back a richer man. I hit the biggest track in Klondike history.
dad met me.
Her dad met me.
In Saginaw, Michigan.
Saginaw, Michigan.
He gave me a great big party with champagne. Then he said, son, you're wise, young, ambitious man. Will you sell your father in a lawyer Klondike claim? Now he's up there in Alaska, digging in the cold, cold ground. The greedy fool is looking for the gold I've never found. It serves him right, and no one here is missing him. Least of all, the newlyweds of Saginaw, Michigan, with the happiest man and wife in Saginaw, Michigan. He's ashamed to show his face in Saginaw, Michigan.
Well, I never felt more like singing a blues, 'cause I never thought that I'd ever lose your love. Why'd you do me this way? Well, I never felt more like crying all night, 'cause everything's wrong and nothing ain't right without you. You got me singing the blues. The moon and stars no longer shine. The dream is gone, I thought was mine. There's nothing left for me to do but cry over you. Well, I never felt more like running away, but why should I go? 'Cause I couldn't stay without you. You got me singing the blues. Well, I never felt more like crying all night, 'cause everything's wrong and nothing ain't right without you. You got me singing the blues. The moon and stars no longer shine. The dream is gone, I thought was mine. There's nothing left for me to do but cry over you. Well, I never felt more like running away, but why should I go? 'Cause I couldn't stay without you. You got me singing the blues.
Set a high, getting ideas. Ain't nothing but a fool to live like this. Out all night, running wild. Woman sitting home with a month-old child. Dang me, dang me. They ought to take a rope and hang me high from the highest tree. Woman, would you weep for me? Sitting around drinking with the rest of the guys. Six rounds bought and I bought five. Spent the groceries and half the rent, like $14.27. Well, dang me, dang me. They ought to take a rope and hang me high from the highest tree. Woman, would you weep for me? They say roses are red and violets are purple, and sugar's sweet and so's maple syrup. And I'm the seventh out of seven sons. My pappy was a pistol, I'm a son of a gun. I said, dang me, dang me. They ought to take a rope and hang me high from the highest tree.
woman, would you weep for me? Boo, 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 boo.
Lord, preserve us and protect us. Mando Richard has Whiskey Before Breakfast. Tune in to WRCT's Folk and Bluegrass Show, Whiskey Before Breakfast, Wednesdays at 11 a.m. You'll hear a wide range of folk music, traditional and contemporary fiddle tunes and songs galore. Be sure to catch WRCT's Whiskey Before Breakfast at 11 a.m. Wednesdays right here on 88.3 FM, WRCT Pittsburgh, or streaming WRCT.org.
The first thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, and no one could change my mind but Mama tried. The one and only rebel child from a family meek and mild, my Mama seemed to know what lay in store. In spite of all my Sunday learning, towards the bad I kept on turning, till Mama couldn't hold me anymore. I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. Mama tried, Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried. Rest his soul, left my mom a heavy load. She tried so very hard to fill his shoes, working hours without rest, wanted me to have the best. She tried to raise me right, but I refused. And I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. Mama tried, Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried.
Street in town, pardon me if I don't say hello. I belong to another. It wouldn't look so good to know someone I'm not supposed to know. Just walk on by, wait on the corner. I love you, but we're strangers when we meet. In a dimly lit corner at a place outside of town, tonight we'll try to say goodbye again. Tomorrow night, I can't let you go, so why pretend? Just walk on by, wait on the corner. I love you.
walk on by. Wait on the corner. I love you, but we're strangers when we meet. I love you, but we're strangers when we meet.
You've painted up your lips and rolled and curled your tinted hair. Are you contemplating going out somewhere? The shadow on the wall tells me the sun is going down. Started that old crazy Asian war, but I was proud to go and do my patriotic chore. And yes, it's true that I'm not the man I used to be. Some company. It's hard to love a man whose legs are bent and paralyzed. And the wants and the needs of a woman your age, Ruby, I realize. But it won't be long, I've heard them say, until I'm not around. Take your love to town. She's leaving now, 'cause I just heard the slamming of the door. The way I know I've heard it slam 100 times before. And if I could move, I'd get my gun and put her in the ground. Take your love to town. For God's sakes, turn around.
The stillness as it yields to the sound of your heart beating. Bum, bum, bum. And I can almost hear the echo of the thoughts that I know you must be thinking. Bum, bum, bum. And I can feel your body tremble as you wonder what this moment holds in store. Bum, bum, bum. And as I put my arms around you, I can tell you've never been this far before. Bum, bum, bum. I don't know what I'm saying as my trembling fingers touch forbidden places. Bum, bum, bum. I only know I've waited for so long for the chance that we are taking. Bum, bum, bum. I don't know and I don't care what made you tell. Taste your tender kisses, I can tell
You've never been this far before. Boom, boom, boom. And as I take the love you're giving, I can feel tension building in your mind. Boom, boom, boom. Mm-hmm. Boom, boom, boom. And you're wondering if tomorrow I'll still love you like I'm loving you tonight. Boom, boom, boom. Mm-hmm. Boom, boom, boom. You have no tonight will only make me love you more. And I hope that you'll believe me, 'cause I know you've never been this far before. Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum, bum.
Craft game, going back in the alley. And I kept rolling them seven and winning all them pots. My luck was so good, I could do no wrong. I just kept on rolling and controlling them bones. Finally, they threw up their hand and said, when you hot, you hot. I said, yeah.
When you're hot, you're hot. And when you're not, you're not.
Put all the money in and let it roll again.
When you're hot, you're hot.
Something behind me. I turned around and there was a big old cop. He said, hello, boy. Then he gave us a grin and said, look like I'm gonna have to haul y'all in and keep all that money for evidence. I said, well, son, when you hot, you hot.
He said, yeah, when you're hot, you're hot. When you're not, you're not.
You can explain it all down in City Hall. I said, yeah, when you're hot, you're hot. In the court, I couldn't believe my eyes. The judge was a fishing buddy that I recognized. I said, hey, judge, old buddy, old pal, I'll pay you that $100 if you get me out of this spot. So he gave my friends a little fine to pay. He turned around and grinned at me and said, 90 days, Jerry, when you're hot.
My mother was always very active and independent, and she was familiar with her neighborhood. But one day, she stopped at the stop sign for much longer than usual. She wasn't even really sure where she was at.
It's important for you to talk to someone about it. I felt so much better after my son told me, Mom, we'll figure it out.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. Visit alz.org/ourstories to learn more. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
No matter how large or small your digging project may be, no matter how urban or rural, you must always call 811 before any digging project. 811 is our national one-call number, alerting your local utility companies to come out and mark any lines they have near your dig site. So before you do this or this, make sure you do this. For digging projects big or small, make the call to 811, brought to you by Common Ground Alliance.
Hi, I'm Cynthia Plastercaster, and I always listen to WRCT when I'm in Pittsburgh because only talented people are played on this station.
Hey, kids, it's Krusty the Clown. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. All right, where's my money? What? Chintzy college
I'm around in Pittsburgh, which is always because I'm omnipresent.
I listen to every radio station at the same time, including WRCT, Pittsburgh.